Father Roy Bushma worked before in Bolivia, where he began to discover the things of the poor in Latin America, facing repressive governments who keep them in poverty through tremendous violence against those who organized the change. And as he became increasingly active in working on behalf of the poor throughout Latin America, he began to discover more and more the risks of their oppression in the United States. And when six Jesuit priests were massacred in El Salvador, along with two women who lived in their rectory and helped them, Congressman Joseph Mulkey, who died this week, launched an investigation to find out what happened to them, and discovered that the officers who were involved in their murder were officers who were trained here in the United States at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. And so Father Roy went to Georgia and began learning as much as he could about the school, and rented an apartment across the street from the school, set up shop to begin learning what was happening there. And as it became increasingly clear, this was a school of torture, a school of assassins, a school of terror, training some of the worst human rights violators in Latin America, he and others began witnessing their first republic fasts, then for acts of civil disobedience, and eventually built into a movement which has come within 10 votes in the House of Representatives passing a bill to close down the school, and which has brought about the largest acts of civil disobedience in U.S. history, with thousands of people crossing the line on the Fort Benning to protest the School of the Americas and call for it to be shut down. The movement, in fact, has been so successful, the school has changed its name to the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, hoping that people will remember who they are. But the movement continues because the terror there continues. I met Father Roy when we were both in Colombia in January investigating the suffering of the people there and the impact of U.S. military aid on the people. And the SOA played a big role in training a lot of the worst human rights abuses there. And so it's imperative for us to keep our focus. And I'm very pleased and honored to welcome Father Roy, and I'm very grateful to all of you for being here with us.
For me, it's a joy to be with you, an honor to be with you this morning. What I would like to do is speak for a few minutes and then open it up for discussion. The issue that I'm going to be speaking about, it's a serious issue, in that it's about suffering, it's about oppression of our sisters and brothers in Latin America. It's about a school, a combat school at this large army post, Fort Benning, Georgia, that every year trains about 1,000 soldiers from Latin America in how to be commandos in psychological warfare and counterinsurgency. And we have documented hundreds of these soldiers who have gone back to their home countries and they've committed crimes against their people. And we are trying to shut down this school. We believe that it should not exist. I want to begin by saying that I think that we're called to be peacemakers in our world, healers, to struggle for justice. But we need, on this journey that each of us are on, we need others to help us, to sustain us, to educate us. Coming out of a small town in Louisiana, we didn't talk much about what we're going to talk about this morning. we left our country's foreign policy to those in Washington. We did never, in my little town, confront that the issue of racism that was so alive. We didn't talk about this issue of sexism. Words like oppression, exploitation of the world were never dealt with. I went off to college there at the State University, got a degree in geology with the hope of getting rich in the oil fields of South America. After college, Vietnam was in the making. Being a patriotic young man, I became a naval officer and spent the next 4 years in the military. It was sort of my ticket out of Louisiana. I was aboard ship for a couple of years, loved the sea. Went off to this naval station in Europe. And then when our leaders were asking for volunteers to go off to Vietnam to stop the spread of communism to a country we knew so little about, its people, its culture, so much older than our own. I didn't hesitate. I went off to Vietnam, as many of us did, young men that we were. Vietnam was a turning point for many of us. The violence there, the suffering we saw, began to change us. Losing friends there, wounded when I was there, I was really forced to ask questions I hadn't asked before. I met a missionary there near our base at this orphanage. I care for about 300 children. I would go there to do volunteer work with some of my buddies. And for the first time, I started really to see Vietnam through the eyes of the children, the victims. Again, for the first time, to question this whole issue of violence. We were there as warriors. We were the men with the guns. And for the first time, I began to question what I was doing there. But it was the beginning of something that was stirring up in me. We've all been there. We began to have an awakening. We began to realize that the road that we're traveling is not the one we want to stay on. We're being called in new directions. And I was beginning to believe that the way of nonviolence, the way of peace, the way of somehow trying to ally ourselves with the suffering poor of our world was the way that would bring meaning to my life, not knowing where all of that was going to go. I left Vietnam so happy to be alive, come home with family and friends. Then I went off to the seminary in New York to prepare for my studies in the priesthood. Was ordained a Catholic priest and then was assigned to our missions in Bolivia. Struggled through language school there in Cochabamba, and then went off to La Paz, a slum there. I got a small room and began living with people there. And really, it was in Bolivia over the next 5 years that was, for me, another turning point. It was there in Bolivia, living with the poor, they became my teachers. They began to educate me, North American, about what my country, the United States, was doing in Bolivia and throughout Latin America. There we were supporting a brutal dictator, General Banza, who had come into power through a violent coup. And his men with the guns were running the country. There was the CIA very active there. The large corporations coming in, the multinationals from our country, the developing world, seeking profits. Where the huge profits to be made from the cheap labor and the vast resources there. Just as the conquistadors came into Latin America in the 16th century to enrich themselves, so too today we have the new conquistadors. We have those coming in from the large corporations, those representing the sweatshops, the FTA, bringing in the policies of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. These we can call the new conquistadors coming into Latin America for the same reasons, to make huge profits off of the cheap labor there and the vast resources. The repression intensified. I was very happy there in the body of working in health and educational projects, trying to solve any of the problems there, improving the quality of life. I was among a group arrested at the university. We formed a human rights group to try and defend ourselves from the repression, many arrested. And I was forced out of Bolivia, could not return. Came home, and then became very involved with a lot of friends, this issue of El Salvador, Central America. A small country whose government was at war with its people, the poor. It was years ago, 1980, that Archbishop Oscar Romero was gunned down at the altar in this little church for his defense of the poor. We had four churchwomen from the United States working with the poor there who were raped and killed for their defense of the poor. And when we went there, many of us, to try and find out what was going on, we found really a microcosm of Latin America. How a small elite over time had confiscated most of the land for themselves, who had the power of the realm, and also had the military on their side to protect their power in the realm. And what we saw there was our country giving guns to those soldiers doing the killing. And that was wrong. That was really a crime against humanity. And when 500 soldiers came from El Salvador to Fort Benning, Georgia, to start training in combat, now on U.S. soil, I and friends went there to protest. We gave talks in some colleges and high schools there. And then the moment came to take the message to the Salvadoran soldiers on Fort Benning. Three of us, Linda Ventimiglia, who was in the Army Reserves, trained at Fort Benning, Larry Rosebaum, who had worked with the poor in Brazil, and I, we went down to this Army surface place, Ranger Joe's. We bought Army uniforms. We dressed as high-ranking Army officers. We went on to Fort Benning. It was at night. We had with us a very powerful boom box that contained the last sermon of this Archbishop Oscar Romero that he gave in the cathedral the day before he was assassinated, where he made a special plea to the men in the military to stop the killing, to lay down their arms, to disobey their superiors telling them to kill and obey a higher law that says thou shalt not. We took his message in Spanish in this boom box. We entered Fort Benning, high security area there, got saluted. We were scared. It was a big salute. We went near the barracks, and we had troop fighters, and Larry and I, we scaled this tall pine tree. And we waited. And about 10 o'clock at night, when the lights went out, he said, "Bishop Romero, this is for you, brother." And his voice just boomed into the barracks. They were very upset with us. They came out, some of those soldiers looking in the sky, a little frightened by this voice coming out of the darkness. The instructors came out with their M16s, threatened to shoot us down. And it was time to come down. Left the boom box up there, blasting me. We came down, they punched us, they kicked us around. And then they took us to the county jail. and then to trial before this well-known segregationist judge, Maxim Ambal, who's become very well-known in this movement. Didn't like protesters, sent Martin Luther King to prison and other civil rights leaders. Didn't like us. Charged us with criminal trespassing and impersonating county officers, and sent us to prison for a year and a half. Glenda went to a prison in Kentucky, Larry to Texas, and they sent me to Minnesota. Prison was hard, but we learned something very important, that they could send us to prison, but they could not silence us. The truth cannot be silenced. We spoke from prison, hundreds of letters. We had a lot of meeting interviews. And when we got out of prison, we went back to work, joining a growing number of people in our country, trying to stop that military aid in El Salvador. But we couldn't do it. And the President Reagan, Bush, the aid continued. It got up to about $1 million a day. And the bloodshed continued. Another massacre. Front pages of our newspapers. November the 16th, 1980, there at this university in San Salvador, after midnight, six Catholic priests of the Jesuit order, the influential order of priests, they were in Georgetown, Fordham, Loyola, Marquette, there were 20 universities around the country. These six Jesuit priests, along with their co-worker, a young mother, and her 15-year-old daughter, Selena, dragged out of their rooms and shot at close range. A U.S. congressional task force went to El Salvador to investigate, headed by Representative Joseph Moakley, who just died a few days ago. Today, he was just a good person who really walked with the poor black America. He came back, his task force, and reported that those responsible for this massacre of the two women and the six Jesuits were training at the U.S. Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. That's when I decided leave my work here in Minnesota, where I was doing educational work at a Peace Center in Minneapolis. And with the support of my Maryknoll community, went down to Georgia, found this little apartment right outside of the main gate of Fort Benning, and just knew that we had to start investigating this story. Called it the SOA Watch. Friends joined me. Kathy Kelly came from Chicago, doing a lot to be on Iraq, Voices in the Wilderness, that she started. Charlie Litke came, Vietnam veteran, recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor in Vietnam, who today is doing a year at a federal prison in California for his protest at the school. Some Salvadorans came. We began with a very serious water-only fast that went 35 days. We camped out at the main gate of Fort Benning. Didn't eat, sustained ourselves on water. Our bodies grew very weak, but the spirit was strong. And after the fast, we had a lot of work to do. Through human rights reports, through the Freedom of Information Act, we began to gather information about this school that was well known in Latin America as a school of assassins, as a school for dictators, as a school for death squad leaders. Some of those graduates, General Manuel Noriega from Panama, well known, who's now spending 30 years at a federal prison in Miami for drug running. The school began way back in the 1940s in Panama, trained over 60,000 soldiers. And in 1984, it's forced out of Panama to grow in protest there and settles on U.S. soil at Fort Benning, where today it's operating full force. our research, all documented, show that soldiers who left this school after their combat training went back to their home countries like El Salvador and killed not only the Jesuits and the young mother and her daughter, Selena, but were responsible for the rape and murder of the four church women, three nuns and a lay worker from Cleveland, Ohio. They were responsible for this massacre of Albuquerque in El Salvador, where over 800 were killed, including over 100 children. And in Peru, they were responsible for the death of 9 university students there. And in Honduras, the vet squad leaders there. And in Colombia today, most of the graduates coming from Colombia. How the military trained at this school, over 10,000 of them from Colombia, are very connected to the paramilitaries, the death squads in Colombia. Here's the way it worked. We knew that if we got our research involved in so much suffering and death of sisters and brothers in Latin America, if we got this information into the hands of students, into churches and synagogues, into peace groups, people would pay attention to this. And sure enough, they did. Groups came on board, national organizations. High schools and colleges began to address this issue. And basically saying, no, not even my name will this continue. Editorials began to appear in major newspapers calling for the closing of this school, the School of the Americas. Again, a school training all these soldiers from Latin America, over 1,000 every year, in combat schools. All financed with our tax money to the tune of about $20 million a year. And we were saying, let's shut down this operation and use that money into schools for our kids here at home. Let's use that money to social programs, programs that are going to help, not destroy. Every spring, we would go to Washington. We fasted on the steps of the Capitol for 40 days, a juice-only fast in the early days, and got the attention of Joe Kennedy and Joe Mulkey and others. They started joining our calls in Congress, introducing bills that called for the closing of the school. The first vote, way back in 1993, closed the school. The vote was 174 to 256. And we had a lot of work to do. And we had to go through Congress because they, our leaders, our representatives and senators, they control that money. It's our money being used at a school that we feel should be shut down. So we would go there every spring to lobby. And every time they would vote, the gap would close. And last year, we got within just 10 votes. And Representative Joseph Mulkey really took a leadership in this issue in the House of Representatives. And let me move on here. We started going to Columbus, Georgia, all before every November. We gather at the main gate to keep alive the memory of the victims, to speak for those whose voices were taken away. That first November, we had maybe a small group, about 10 of us. And then the next year, next November, 100 came. And the next year, 300 came. And this last November, 10,000 from all over the country. Half of those there, about 5,000 there, were students, high school and college students from all over the country, from the West Coast, the East Coast, and from the South, colleges and high schools. We had a lot of senior citizens there, parents with their children, a lot of veterans, World War II vets, Vietnam vets. We're all there representing a very, very strong, diverse movement. We were there to speak as one voice, saying, we want that school shut down. We had a lot of speakers and good musicians to uplift the spirit. Pete Seeger was there this last couple of years. Martin Sheen came, spoke as the president, he said. As the acting president, I declare that this school of the Americas be shut down immediately. The crowd's going wild. That Sunday, the memorial service, a sacred time, to really connect ourselves in a special way to the poor Black America. They painted this white line right across the road, right in front of this big sign that says, welcome to Fort Benning. And they say, if we cross that line, we're going to be arrested. And we say, there's a higher law to be followed today. You're saying that we're going to break this law. There's a higher law. There's a law that says we are called to be peacemakers in our world. There's a law of our conscience that we know in our heart to be true. We're going to follow the truth today. We're going to follow a law of conscience that says we're called to walk in solidarity with the poor. And on this day, that's the law we're going to follow. Among 10,000 gathered in front of Fort Benning, 3,500 enter Fort Benning, carrying coffins, crosses, some of the Star David, with the names of the victims. And the names over the PA system, one by one, are called out. And after each name, there's the presented. Everyone says in unison, presented. This person is present with us today. A very, how shall we say, spiritual, sacred moment. A number of people, students and senior citizens, many of them entering out, they're actually weeping. It just was such a connection and a way to others. And down the road, this big solemn funeral procession is stopped. 3,500 people are stopped about a mile down the road. And they're arrested. They're brought to these large hangars where they're processed. And of those arrested, 26 of our people were brought to trial just last week in Columbus, Georgia. 26 of them. Cited for trespassing. They singled out a cross-section of our group, making up this big movement of people. In our group of 26 who went to trial at the federal courthouse in Columbus, Georgia last week, was Rachel Hayward, 19 years old, a sophomore at Kalamazoo College in Michigan. There were school teachers, mothers, there were some veterans in the group, senior citizens. The oldest in the group was Sister Dorothy Hennessy, a Catholic nun, 88 years old. And she said to the judge, she said, you know, I've been a nun for 50 years. And she says, I'm not used to the comfortable lifestyle. And I'm ready for prison if you're going to send me there. And he did. 24 of them got sentenced. 6 months in prison, and the judge gave them 6 months. Well, we've got a year. Half women and half men, they're all going to prison in about a month. They're going to be reported to these federal prisons. Going to this prison in Illinois will be 8 of the women, Rachel and Sister Dorothy and 6 other women. That prison will never be the same. But let me say this. They're going to prison to energize our movement. 50 of us before this group went to prison have been to prison before. And collectively, 50 of us were crossing that white line in November. Collectively, we have served a total of 30 years in federal prisons. They thought they could send us to prison and kill our movement. But every time they would send us to prison and bring us to trial, we would put this school on trial. And it would just bring new attention to the issue. And every time they sent us to prison, and the same will be working for this group, more people will be coming in November. And I've been there. I've crossed that line a few times. It's spent over 3 years in federal prisons now. And I've decided, being inspired by Sister Dorothy and Rachel and others, that I'll be crossing that white line again in November. With many, many others. We have a few thousand crossing, more this year than last. I can only say this, that we're not going away. It was January the 17th, just a few months ago, that the Pentagon, under intense pressure, was forced to do something. The movement has gotten so big. They've decided to change the name of the school. It's now called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. Let me just say this. It's a new name, but the same shame. For us, it's like taking a bottle of poison and putting penicillin on it. It's still deadly. Representative Mokas said it very well. He said it's like taking perfume and putting it on a toxic dump. It's still deadly. It's still a toxic dump. Let me say this. This issue is especially serious now because most of the soldiers there are coming from Colombia. Colombia has trained over 10,000 soldiers here. Sean mentioned that he and I and others were on a delegation to Colombia just a few months ago to look into this plan Colombia. Our country is giving $1.3 billion to Colombia to stop the flow of cocaine from Colombia to the U.S. by 80%, they say, coming from Colombia. So we went there. We talked with the military, the highest ranking of the military, General Tavis, met with their vice president, our U.S. ambassador, and others. The military loves this plan. They're benefiting. They're getting 75% of the money. It's also enriching themselves. But then we went into Putumayo, southern part of the rainforest of Colombia, to really look into Plan Colombia, how it is being implemented. And what Plan Colombia is doing, it's dropping this strong, spraying a strong chemical on the coca leaves, plants, that gives us the raw material for the cocaine. So they're spraying this glyphosate, strong chemical known here as Roundup, much more potent there, produced by Monsanto, who brought us Asian Orange in Vietnam. And these planes are spraying this strong chemical over these plants. And it's killing not only the plants, it's killing their corn, their mountain crops, their food sources. It's going into the rivers, killing their fish. It's causing a lot of problems among their children, respiratory problems. I'm struggling with asthma. I think we can go back to that trip to Colombia. But it's causing a lot of skin rashes among the children, the strong chemicals. And we met with the indigenous leaders there. And they gave us, as North Americans, a very important message. They said, please try to stop as much as you can this plant in Colombia. This fumigation, this spraying, it's killing not only Mother Earth, it's killing us. And those Black Hawk helicopters, that's being produced by the corporation of Sikorsky in Connecticut. They, of course, are making huge profits from those contracts. millions of dollars to turn out these Black Hawk helicopters to be used not only to fight the drug war, but they say the counterinsurgency efforts there. But we are there caught right up in the middle of it. And the question is, have we learned anything from Vietnam, from El Salvador? Our country is dropping this strong chemical, and it's got to be stopped. There's a sign of hope we read in this morning's paper that the president of Colombia, Pastrana, he seems to be saying now that this spraying has to stop. That has to be confirmed, because we are there with a lot of power saying that it must continue. The indigenous also told us that they're not only, and this is not about the drug war, that this really is about those huge oil reserves on their land, that we want, that we need to maintain our lifestyle here in the United States, and to keep those profits of the large corporations coming. We need access to more oil reserves. And there's huge oil reserves in Colombia, on the land of the indigenous, and they are being forced off of their land. I'm happy to say, as I travel around the country, a lot of colleges and high schools, there are a lot of environmentalists, human rights activists, animal rights activists, coming together and reorganizing against Plan Colombia. There's more to be said, but I want to stop. I want to hear from you. I think what you're talking about, though, are issues that connect to other issues. And we can all do something. Bishop Romero said that when we struggle in this struggle for peace and justice, we can all do something and do it well. It took me a long time to find out, kind of where to plug in. That I had a voice, that there were many people out there who were really working for peace and justice, working for a better world, a world of nonviolence, a world where sisters and brothers won't have to go to bed hungry at night, a world where countries like Bolivia, El Salvador, Indonesia, and so many other countries, that they can have schools for their children. That when their kids get sick, there's a hospital they can go to. And so many are deprived of that. Who are living on the edge, struggling for survival, dying before their time. And this, of course, is not the way it should be. And we all can do something to help bring about this world that we really want. And what I really find a lot of meaning in are the words of this Bishop Ken Oscar Romero, who said, "Let those who have a voice speak for the voiceless." We have a voice. We have a voice, you and I. And I just hope that we can use our voices in clear and bold ways to help bring about more peace in our world. But let me stop there. What I would like to do is open it up for your comments and questions that you might have.
Bulkley and a few others as people in our own Congress that are concerned about this, and I wondered if there's any bipartisan support, if any conservatives or Republicans have crossed party lines to join with Democrats on this.
Very important question. Thank you. Just before Joe Bulkley reported, we met with him actually after our delegation to Colombia, and it was at that meeting that he informed us. He's been very good to work with over the years. He said that he would continue to fight now to close this new school. And since then, it was the next week that he informed the public that he had this incurable leukemia and just a few days ago died. We're going to miss Joe. But he said, what we're going to do is a team effort to close the school. And we've got actually a new bill thanks to Joe Mulkey putting that sort of in motion. It's Bill H.R. House Resolution 1810. And we've got six co-sponsors. Joe Mulkey was the co-sponsor. His name will continue to be on the bill. And we've got Jim McGovern from Massachusetts. We've got another Democrat. And we have three Republicans. Mm-hmm. One, Joe Scarborough from Florida, and two other Republicans. Something there, this is 1810. Right now we've got 35 co-sponsors. We've got a lot of work to be done, of course. There's going to be a vote later, probably in early fall. Very important for New Hampshire. Your two representatives are not on board. Representatives John Sununu and Charlie Bass have supported this School of the Americas and support this new name school, as have your Senators Smith and Gregg. Letters to them, personal visits, perhaps a small group of you representing the school or group, going there to personally appeal to them would be very important, very important. We've got work to do here. Please.
I went lobbying there
yes.
with Sununu and Bass
yes.
about this issue, and they were dead set against it. We didn't get anywhere. We talked, and they didn't listen to us at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it was just because we were youth or whatever, but they seemed very adamant that School of America was a good thing.
Yes. In response to that, let me say, that first vote was 174, 256. This is in a democratically controlled Congress, early on, 1993, when Joe Kennedy was taking leadership on the issue. This is what we learned. When that representative will start getting more and more letters on this issue, they will come around. And I've met a number of those representatives, and I've asked them, what was it really that changed your vote? And they said, I received so many letters, short letters from the heart, but letters with passion, from so many of my constituents, people in my district, that I had no choice. I had to change my vote. And that's the way it worked for a lot of them. And I'm convinced that with our representatives here in New Hampshire, I don't know what the problem is, but for many, they've never been to Latin America, or if they go to Latin America, as many of our representatives do on these fact-finding missions, they talk to our embassy people. They talk to the higher-ranking military there. They don't really go out into the field and spend, even if it's an hour, with how the majority of the people there live, the campesinos, and simply ask them, what's life like for you here? What do you kids go to school? And so often they're going to be told, no hay una escuela aquí, señor. There's no school here. And if your kids get sick right now, where are they going to go to get cured? Where are they going to go to get these medicines or this surgery? And they will be told, no, apostles, it's impossible. This is not possible. We don't have a clinic. We don't have medicine. We don't have a hospital here. And so much of these budgets, it's incredible. Millions, and in Colombia, billions, going into armaments, going into the hands of the military, to support a system really that keeps the rich in the poor. And all I think we'd be asking of a lot of our members of Congress is to go there and try and see life from the underside, not from the top. But again, letters are really, really important. Also important, come November, I was just up at Colby College in Maine. And I didn't know this, there were 26 students there who drove 28 hours in these vans to attend last November's vigil. We're going to be there again this year, November the 16th, 17th, and 18th, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And invite you to consider bringing a group perhaps representing your school. There are a lot of students at Oakland College out in Ohio. They actually, there are a couple of their students who have trials pending. Right after the trial, some of the Oakland students were there. They right after the trial and the sentencing of Rachel and Sister Dorothy and the others, this group of students from Oakland went, got them off guard, went to the headquarters of the School of the Arts, and had this yellow, this tape, crime scene, tape you see. And they went to the main entrance, there were six of them, and they wrapped this crime scene tape all through the entrance there with a formal letter they drafted from the commandant of the school, saying that as our protesters have given a ban and bar letter preventing them from entering Fort Benning in the future, we give you this letter of notice that you are barred from going to Latin America with your soldiers who bring so much suffering and death there. They were arrested, and they probably, I don't know when, but probably in the near future will also be coming to trial. But again, there's an invitation to be with us in November. We are going to have more than 10,000 this November. This is our prediction. And your coming to be with us would be a great blessing for the movement there. Time to meet a lot of other students from all over the country. For those who cannot, many cannot come at distance, expensive, time-consuming. We are asking for solidarity actions all over the country. A lot of high schools and colleges are conducting solidarity actions on their campus, at their schools. For those who cannot go, or there might be a small group going, so they'll be doing something in solidarity with that group. I'm going to leave with you, with Doug, a video, a new video called SOA Guns and Greed that can be circulated here. It's a good resource we just produced, a new documentary. 20 minutes. It's connecting this issue, the School of the Americas issue, to the globalization issue, to the economic giants, to those who run the sweatshops, to the managers of multinational corporations who go down to look for profits, of course. And these soldiers trained at this school go back to Latin America and provide the muscle, really, for the large corporations, for the economic giants. They are the enforcers. One thing we have come to, that economic system that's so alive out there in the developing world couldn't be there making those huge profits from the cheap labor, the vast resources, without the militaries, without the men with the guns. So this new video, SOA Guns and Greed, is a good resource, I think, to better understand this issue. I'll leave a few copies here.
The answer is probably obvious. People who are promoting peace and struggling against violence are arrested and sent to prison. How many of the people who have trained the killers and the torturers, how many of the people who have applied the weapons of human violence and environmental violence, how many of those people in the United States have done prison time for their crimes?
I tell you, that's the issue. That's what really, a lot of people see this for what it is. About 24, in our group, our new group, will be going to prison within about a month. To these federal prisons all over the country, and 50 before then have gone to prison. Those who killed the mother and the daughter and the six Jesuits, 19 were found to be guilty. They went to trial there in El Salvador. They were found guilty and they were convicted. I mean, that massacre was well investigated. It was high profile. Pages all over the world. They were pardoned after the trial. But that says a lot about the power of the military down there. In Guatemala, as in El Salvador, Honduras, Peru, you cannot touch these guys. They are so powerful. They come out with, some what they call the human rights reports, like in Guatemala, but you cannot name them. You cannot name them, call them by name. They cannot be prosecuted. If they are prosecuted, they are pardoned. They get amnesty. But one thing that we're also calling for, very important, is a truth commission. See, they closed this school thinking that it's amazing. This really angered us. The new commandant of the school said, well, the School of the Americas is closed now. We don't want to talk about all of these past graduates and their crimes. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. We are calling this bill, 1810, it's not only to close down this new main school, but to investigate its graduates for their crimes against humanity. It's to call for a truth commission. Will we get that? There are many in Congress who will try to stop that. If enough people in our country demand that, as in South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation Committee to investigate the crimes during apartheid in South Africa. Let me just say this. There will never, ever be healing in El Salvador and other countries until there is what's called the Truth Commission, until the truth comes out. There can never be the reconciliation. There can never be the forgiveness, like Desmond Tutu said in Africa, South Africa. People are willing to forgive, but they want to know who they have to forgive. It's because of your question, Peter, that I asked. When I went to this last prison in Estelle, South Carolina, I refused to work. When you go to federal prison, you got to work. Everybody works. Not only that, you make 9 cents an hour when you work. But I got to this prison for that last protest and for crossing the line 6 months. We had 25 of us in that. And when I got to this prison, I just said to the warden, I'm not working until those who did the killing start doing their time. I'll do my time, and maybe their time. Well, in prison, there's not a whole lot of dialogue about this. I was just handcuffed and brought to what's called whole solitary confinement, where I spent a couple of months in 6x9 cell. We all like a lot of, we all like solitude and quiet time, but I was getting OD on it. It was they bring in your food there. And, it's like room service, actually. But yeah, a lot of time spent. And I give you a lot of thank you. And just on a personal note, I had no regrets for what I did, where I ended up. Something I want to just make on a personal note. I was separated from my support group, my community, my friends. And I started getting a lot of questions. It seemed so clear on the outside, when you're with friends, organized, doing things together. And all of a sudden, I'm in this cell, cut off from everybody. And as the weeks unfolded into the months there, I started to have doubts. I started to question this whole issue of how effective we've been in our work. As peace activists, as many of us who work peace and justice on many different issues, Sean deals with this at the New Hampshire Peace Action we all deal with this. How effective are we in our work? We want to see results. You as students who don't work so hard, you want to see results for your labor. And I was looking for results, and I must say, I started to question how effective we were being. The school, we've been at this for 11 years now. It was my third year in prison, and I was beginning to get tired of questioning what we were doing, our tactics. Is this going to end? But something really happened in the solitude of the cell there. And it came through in the words of this wonderful woman, Dorothy Day, who started all these houses of hospitality for the poor, who started soup kitchens, who started tax resistance, who was just such a dedicated peace activist. I mean, she lived it out in her life, her whole life. And she said this. What really is important, she said, was not to concentrate on being effective, but really to try to be faithful. Faithful to what we know in our minds, in our conscience, in our hearts, to be the truth. To follow the truth wherever that will lead us. And not ask, you know, who's following. Not to try and judge how effective we are in what we do. Sure, we want to see results, but I latched on to her words in this small book that I had. I never heard that before, but in this cell, it took on a lot of meaning. And I believe that, and I pass that on to you, is that sometime you start questioning how effective you are in what you're doing, something, again, that you're trying to live out in your life, and you don't see results. Because it gets to be lonely sometimes. We started off with a very, very small group in the early days. And now there's a big movement. And it's huge. It's growing. But we still ask that question, you know, how are we going to be effective? But most important is how to hold on to the truth. How to hold on to our integrity. And I knew that my going to prison was what I had to do, not others. No. It's one way, one of many ways. But what's important for each of us to find out how we can really do what we know we got to do and hold on to our integrity. We can all do something and do it well. And one last thing, the hardest part for Sean and I were talking about this. Was having prison was easy compared to dealing with my family. They were upset. They were upset. They were scared. They were worried. Prison is not a pleasant place. And I have to, because my family comes from a working class, you know, family. They love me, I love them, my brothers and sisters, and this and that. So they, when I go to jail, they worry about me. And they couldn't understand why I was doing this. But through letters from prison, visits in prison, now they understand. It took a lot of work. But one thing I've learned too is that we've got to take our loved ones, our families, our friends, who might not understand what we're doing, to be patient, to understand why they don't understand at first, and help them, you know, travel with us, walk the walk.
Please. This kind of follow-up on what you're saying, I'm struck by how it is not only you, but lots of other people who are involved in peace activist movements come out of religious traditions. That feels to me really important to know this somehow. And I'm sure that's not, I know that's not the only place the peace activists come. But it seems that there are a lot of very impressive people who come with that sense of faith and integrity that you were just mentioning. Kathy Kelly came and spoke here last year. She was astonishing.
Yeah.
But I have that same feeling that you're expressing now. I wonder if you could say anything more about this kind of delicate question in our secular society of the relationship between your identity as a priest and your identity as an activist against violence.
Long ago, I came to the conclusion that this whole issue of faith, no matter what our faith tradition might be, that it has to be integrated with peace and justice issues, with nonviolence, with serving the poor. It's so integral to that. In the early days, I grew up a traditional, what you might call a Sunday Catholic. You know, Sunday, a lot of people go to church, church of their choice, and it's sort of like a spiritual lollipop often. It doesn't bring us into the world. It kind of, like Karl Marx would say, I mean, often it paralyzes us. It becomes like a drug. Rather than bringing us into the struggle of the poor, it keeps us comfortable. It keeps us separated. And I started seeing that. And I see that today, how so many of our church leaders have become corporate executives, how many of our shepherds have become government sheep, how we don't identify ourselves as people of faith, whatever that tradition is, to stand for something. We don't identify ourselves, knowing if we do, we're going to take some hits. Like in Columbus, Georgia, I've knocked on so many doors down there. All these students coming in, we want floor space. A lot of them are coming in, they can't afford hotel rooms. So I'm looking for church halls, and I've knocked on so many doors at the pastors down there. Catholic, Baptist, Unitarian Universalist came through for us, the only group there, and the United Methodist Church. And the others said, this is a controversial issue, that we can get involved in this. They're afraid they might lose money coming into the congregation. The pastor's going to get some hits, get criticized. And I can only say now, when we first started coming, learning about the school, the first to come were those who worked in Latin America. A lot of priests, the nuns, and others who had lived with the poor in Latin America and knew what this school was about. But what happened after that, a lot of students started. And what I've learned is that for many of them, as I travel around, some come at it from their whole issue, you know, the spiritual part, there's a faith element here. Some come in it, you know, as agnostics, as atheists. But what I've heard from all, how connecting to the suffering poor here at home or abroad, how that brings meaning and joy to our lives. How that really does something to us. There was a college student we've captured in the video here, actually, who's going on to Fort Benning. And the camera's right there, said, you know, why are you doing this? And he says, he's a freshman, I think, in college, he says, this is not about us. This is about others. I'm here to speak for them. But what also has to be said is what happens when we do that. And what we, many of us, have discovered is that when we ally ourselves to others, to speak for them, to fight for them, for justice and peace, it brings in a deep joy into our hearts. And a lot of them talk about that as being spiritual, as connecting, something very sacred. And it's true that, and this is what I like about this movement, it's so diverse. Women and men from all ages and faith traditions come on board. And for many, this faith element is very, very important. And how we kind of discover that along the way. And how I find today we use different words or different language to describe that, unlike years ago, when we grew up in sort of traditional churches, faith communities, we try to, you know, get the mystery and talk about it in such a way that it no longer becomes mystery. But that I see is so important. For many, it's their faith, their deep faith, is something very sacred. Creator, God. It's also something very sacred that many people see in others. And I was asked this by a reporter. I was in Boston not long ago, and they asked this at a huge gathering. Why are so many coming into this community? And all I can think of is that the stories of others, the stories of sisters and brothers are finally being heard here in our country. The story of Selena, the 15-year-old, who was dragged out of her room that night after midnight with her mother in those 6th streets and shot. Her story and who was responsible for her death has finally penetrated into our country, gotten into our consciousness. The story of Rufina Amaya in that El Masoke massacre, this campesina woman, Landis Farmer, her 3 children and her father were among the 800 killed. And she was the sole survivor. Somehow, through grace, through luck, she survived to tell her story. And 2 years ago, we invited her to come to Georgia before, back then we had 7,000 gathered. And she told just her humble story, humble words, about, and she was, a poor woman from El Salvador, who is now here in our country, just talking about El Masoke. And she began to weep, and you could hear in this crowd of thousands, you could hear him drop. And it's her story and the stories of others that are finally touching us here. And we are beginning, of course, to take their stories and educating others. That's the way it works. And let me just say in closing, I think it's about that time. It's been, for me, really, it's been a blessing to be with you this morning. I just hope that some of what I've said, I'm here, I guess, having lived in Latin America. I see myself as simply a messenger. Often Rufina, Selena, and others cannot come to your school and tell their story. They will often rely on us, who have heard of their story and who have lived with their people to travel around. That's why I want to keep doing this work. There are many in our country who don't know yet what our country is doing in Latin America. How this school is such a long thing. And we're going to get it shut down. We're going to get it shut down. And we need your voices, of course, to help us. We need your energy. And lastly, as Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist monk, our brother, says, we really can't bring peace out there, in our world, in our country, unless there's peace right here. We can't work for peace out there unless there's peace right here. And I just wish that for you. That's the challenge for each of us. To hold, as we work for peace in our world, in our community, in our families, that we really, really hold on and build that peace within our own hearts. And that, of course, will lead to an indescribable joy. And it's that joy that I hope each of us can find on our journey. But thank you very much.